Okay, so I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present my work here. So, I'm in the Institute of Mathematical Sciences in Madras, now known as Chennai, India. And my collaborators in this work have been from the Institute of Science in Bangalore, Rahul Pandit, who's a professor there, Ashwin Pandey, who was at that time a graduate student, who is now doing his second PhD in maths at University of Maryland. Shah Jahan, who is currently a graduate student, who's kind of dividing his time between coming to Madras to work with me and working with Rahul. And Abhishek Sen, who was at that time working as a summer student in Bangalore. He helped us with some of the programming. And the other half of the work has been done at Weill Medical College at Cornell with David Christini and Ken Stein, who is one of the clinicians. Okay. So the outline of my talk is as follows. Well, I think that those of you who had been here for the hard workshop has already had lots of the motivation part, but just for completeness, I'll go through it quickly. We'll also discuss about what are cardiac arrhythmias. In particular, the two kinds of arrhythmias I'll be talking about in detail are tachycardia and fibrillation. The conventional treatment of these arrhythmias are pacing with usually an implantable device known as ICD, the implantable cardioverter defibrillator. The reason why physicists are interested in this problem is, of course, the formation of patterns, in particular spirals and spiral breakup leading to chaos and turbulence, which have direct analogy with ventricular tachycardia and ventricular fibrillation, respectively. The two models that we'll be focusing on are, one is the so-called biologically realistic Lou-Rudy model, but as we learned in the hard workshop, these are all bad models. So Lou-Rudy is a bad, complicated model, and the other model, devised by Panfilov, is a simple, bad model. Okay? And we'll see how we can try to control the spiral turbulent state, or in other words, the fibrillatory state. So this is a kind of low amplitude defibrillation motivated by the physics of the pattern formation and what this implies for defibrillation. We'll also be looking at the problem of ventricular tachycardia and how one can use improved algorithms for pacing termination of tachycardia and what is the outlook of this research on cardiac pacing. Okay, so this is the heart, as you can see, and
excuse me, everyone says this, but not expert.
Yeah.
Why are all the models bad?
Okay, the reason
bad
is
compared to what?
Well,
yeah.
Nobody explains what they mean by bad, but that might take a long time.
Yeah, maybe I'll talk about it when I get to the model part. I'll just probably touch on it. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay, so the way the heart normally functions is, here you have got your natural oscillator of the heart, the one which sends out the signal at the so-called 72 beats per minute. So this is sending out the signal which is causing the two upper chambers, the left atria and the right atria, to contract. The signal travels after a short delay to this secondary oscillator known as the atrioventricular node or AV node. So in normal circumstances, this is slaved to the sinus node so that this is always, fires because of a signal coming from sinus node, but it is also capable of independent firing. So the AV node fires after a short delay after the sinus node fires, and this causes pulse of excitation to travel along the two lower chambers, the left ventricle and the right ventricle, and they in turn contract, leading to the normal functioning of the heart. Now the way that things can go bad is that if, for some reason, some localized region of a ventricle starts oscillating at a different frequency in a phase from what the sinus node is giving rise to, that can cause conflict between the pulses given out by sinus node and the pulses given out by this local oscillator. If this is of higher frequency than this one, then whatever happens is inevitable, that the high frequency one overdrives the low frequency sinus node, and this one starts beating at a much higher frequency than what you'd expect from sinus node. since the heart is not built to, you know, function at extremely rapid rates, this enormous high frequency causes inefficient functioning of the heart. And what's worse, this high frequency can often lead to breakup of the synchronization of activity throughout the heart, so that, you know, different regions of your heart start beating at different frequency and different phases. And therefore, the coherent contraction of the heart is totally lost. These different parts are all doing their own different things, and therefore the heart stops pumping blood, and you're dead within a few minutes. So, if you require any motivation, I mean, this is of course quite obvious why we should be motivated to study fibrillation, but still, sudden cardiac death, that is, death in patients who were not suspected of having a, you know, potentially life-threatening cardiac disease, is the leading cause of death in the industrialized world. Just for statistics, there are more than 450,000 deaths in the USA each year due to sudden cardiac death because of ventricular fibrillation. And therefore, it is no doubt one of the most significant problems that you could look at. Understanding the reason why ventricular fibrillation occurs is essential prerequisite for improving the current methods of treating it. And the current method of treating it is giving enormous electrical shocks to the heart in order to reset it, okay? In order to make this entire electrical state go to the resting state and then restart with a sinus node. If you are using an implantable cardiac device, then it requires something like 600 volts. If you're using an external device, so something like you see in your medical soap operas, where this doctor comes in with this paddles and applies it across the chest and shouts clear, and the patient just jumps out of the bed. So Ala in his talk last week was saying that it was something like being kicked by a horse. I was talking to John Milton, who was here 2 weeks back, and he was saying that once he revived a patient who had gone into fibrillation on his operating table, and he just applied this paddle and the patient revived and opened his eyes, and just when he was expecting the patient is going to thank him, the patient grabbed his collar and said, "Don't ever do that to me again." So that kind of gives a qualitative idea how painful this treatment is. Besides the pain, of course, there is a further problem that because of this enormous electrical shocks that you use, you can create scar tissue in the heart itself, which will cause future episodes of ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation. So actually, in trying to save the patient, you're creating the seed for further problems in the future. So what are the possible alternatives? One is, if you can look at how you can use low amplitude perturbations to control spatiotemporal chaos of ventricular fibrillation. And to do that, we need to understand much more detail how we can look at the physics of ventricular fibrillation. So to go into details about ventricular fibrillation, this is a strip chart recording of a patient who went into fibrillation from a sinus rhythm through a tachycardia. So tachycardia, as you can see, is about 5 times faster than your normal sinus rhythm. And then, after some time, that went into this disorganized, almost chaotic kind of tracing, which is characteristic of ventricular fibrillation. So this is, of course, a very coarse-grained view of ventricular fibrillation. Actually, it is a spatiotemporal wave activity, which could only be realized once experimenters were able to actually image the surface of the heart using voltage-sensitive dyes and CCD cameras. So this is a picture from the experiment done by Witkowski's group. But there are other groups who have also done similar kind of imaging. And as you can see, that there is a kind of spiral-shaped wave, which is a characteristic wave pattern on the heart just before the onset of ventricular fibrillation. So this images have led to the, you know, understanding that the underlying cause of ventricular fibrillation is the formation of electrical vortices. So in two dimension, these are spiral waves, and three dimension, these are so-called scroll waves, which create feedback loops or reentrant pathways of electrical activity. So once formed, these are self-sustaining loops which just go on and on with a very high frequency of excitation. And these spiral waves lead to the abnormally rapid heartbeat of tachycardia with a time period of about 200 milliseconds. So this is about 5 times faster than your normal heartbeat. And if untreated, tachycardia often leads to fibrillation in a few seconds through breakup of the spiral wave. So once the spiral wave breaks up, you'll have multiple baby spirals all over the space, each with their own frequency and phase. So spiral waves have become the particular focus of inquiry among physicists working on this problem. And they have been, you know, looked at both in computer models of the so-called anatomically correct models. In this case, it's the dog heart. And also in other actual animal hearts. So this is the case of a rabbit, where you can just roughly see the outline of a spiral. Just a short aside on that spiral waves are actually just one type of reentry. There can be other types of reentry. So actually, reentries have been known in the clinical literature for a long time. But mostly what clinicians had been interested were this anatomically or so-called anatomical reentries, where the reentry is actually about anatomical obstacle or scar tissue. So there is this region of heart. So this is, you know, may have been left behind because of a previous heart attack, myocardial infarction. So this part is inexcitable. So under some circumstances, what can happen is that a wave comes, breaks up, and, you know, just loops around and around this obstacle. So then this forms a very high frequency source of excitation waves. The frequency is, of course, determined by the circumference of this obstacle. But more recently, another kind of reentry has been observed, and which is this spiral wave kind of reentry. So these are known as functional reentries, where you actually don't need an anatomical obstacle. So this can be a region which, you know, for some reason was activated prematurely, and so it went into the so-called refractory state, where for a certain duration it couldn't be excited. And so then the wave came, and it couldn't enter this region and went around it, and once it formed a feedback loop, it was a self-sustaining loop, so it just went round and round. So you don't always need an anatomical obstacle to form a reentrant pathway. So this is the person who's responsible for much of the understanding, preliminary understanding that we have about reentries, George Ralph Mines. As you can see, he died tragically young, and he actually died for his research. So he was found dead in his laboratory with a contraption for applying pacing attached to his heart. So it is often believed that he was actually doing experiments on himself on how pacing, external pacing, affects the cardiac rhythm. So he, just before his death in 1913, he actually performed a series of experiments which led to both this picture of anatomical as well as functional reentries. In particular, he showed that if you take a piece of cardiac muscle, so consider this kind of piece of ring, then under certain circumstances, you can create a loop of reentry around it. So in a normal piece of tissue, if you stimulate some region here, the wave is going to travel in both directions, and they are going to meet and annihilate each other, so that at the end, you're left with a resting piece of tissue. But in an abnormal tissue, you can have preferential conduction only in one direction, so that if you stimulate here, the wave is only going to travel in this direction, and then it's going to form a feedback loop of anatomical reentry. Okay, so this is just a history of ventricular fibrillation. As you can see, that this entire subject started more than 100 years ago. Okay, so this is how ventricular fibrillation is treated currently. In patients who are detected with, who are found to be under a particular risk of ventricular fibrillation, they're advised to undergo a surgery where they're implanted with this device known as an ICD. ICD is a system consisting of a box like this, which consists of a small computer, which is detecting your heartbeat all the time, and whenever it feels that your heart is going into ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation, it applies a programmed stimulation to try to correct it. So this has an electrode which goes all the way to the right ventricle. So this electrode is implanted at the tip of your ventricle. And whenever this detects arrhythmia, this electrode gives electrical stimulation at some pre-programmed arrangement, and hopefully that's going to cure you. So these devices are, of course, a big business nowadays. I think Valentin was commenting last week that something like 60,000 implantations are performed per year. And so therefore, we really hope that these devices are doing what they're supposed to do. They're fairly smart in the sense that they are capable of giving a large variety of treatments. So they can perform pacing, where they give you a sequence of low amplitude pulses to correct this abnormally rapid heartbeat known as tachycardia. If that doesn't work, they are programmed to give a mild shock, which is known as cardioversion. So, if you're a patient, then typically you don't feel pacing at all, whereas cardioversion, you feel like a small thump on your chest. If the device thinks that you're going into fibrillation, it's performed to do defibrillation. So in this scale of things, where this feels like a thump, if you're given defibrillation, you actually pass out. And finally, this is also capable of acting as a pacemaker. So if you have got a slow heartbeat problem, as opposed to a fast heartbeat problem, it can make your heart pace at a more rapid beat. Yeah.
When you say 60,000, that's worldwide or U.S.?
U.S.
And is this implanted
on U.S. and worldwide?
Patients with previous history or
heart? Usually previous history.
No, Not normal.
Because you're not going to implant, this is a serious thing, and it costs something like, how much did Valentin quote? Something like $40,000. So if you're a normal person, I don't expect you're going to.
And what's the chance of computer failure?
The device actually is quite robust. The computer rarely fails. The problem is with the software.
It's not your worst problem.
The problem, as always, is with the software. Yeah.
And the batteries, huh? Typically, you have to be lifetime.
Your lifetime, essentially.
Which is the lifetime. It's usually the extension of the lifetime, the time of the loss, which is 4 years. So, average, these things extend the life of a person for 4 years. That's what Valentin had said.
Right.
Okay. Does it form you?
No, it doesn't.
I don't think you drive a car.
I mean, if you're going into fibrillation, you are already feeling quite unwell, so you're probably lying down when it gives you this big shock.
Yeah, I heard somebody say about that people notice it that they go into fibrillation. And then what they do, what they say is that you hold for something very tight, and then you know now it's going to happen. I don't know. I haven't had it, right? So I don't know.
So this is the way that it's implanted. So typically, it doesn't require an open heart surgery. All they do is open a, this is subcutaneously placed somewhere here. So they just open a flap of skin and put it in. The electrode is, they make a small incision somewhere in your thigh, and they push the electrode through this large vein all the way to your heart. Okay. So at no point is your chest ever opened up and the surgery performed. And this is what the stuff usually looks like. Okay, but as I said, that this present treatment has lots of problems with it. So if we're going to try to do something about it, we must first know what's the system that we're dealing with. So the heart wall, in fact, is quite a complicated structure. So you've got several layers, as you can see. So this is the outer part, and this is the inner part. So at the outer layer, you've got this pericardium, a sac of tissue, which kind of protects the heart. And inside, you've got this heart. The heart wall itself is usually divided into these three layers, this epicardium, the myocardium, and the endocardium. And what we'll be concerned mostly is with the myocardium. So as you can see, the myocardium is consisting of these brick-like cells, which are joined through gap junctions. And if you look in detail at such a structure, you can see that, you know, these are composed of like many cells with capillaries supplying blood to them, interspersed between them. Sorry? Okay. In the left ventricle, which is kind of thicker, this is about 12 millimeter. In the right ventricle, which is thinner, because it only needs to send the blood to the lungs, it is about 4 millimeter. Okay, so since cardiac cells have shared quite a lot of things with neurons, it's no surprise that most of the models of cardiac cells actually are derived from the original Hodgkin-Huxley formulation for the squid axon. So this is a cable model of the cardiac cell. So this is the interior of the cell, this is the outside, and in the resting state, the cell has an excess of potassium ions, whereas the external medium has an excess of sodium ions, and you have a resting membrane potential of minus 85 millivolt. So normally it's in a hyperpolarized state. Now if, for some reason, you know, because of currents coming through the gap junction from the neighboring cells, the cardiac cell becomes excited, then the ion channels sitting on the cell membrane open up and sodium starts rushing in, and you get a sudden spike in the transmembrane potential. So if you're measuring the voltage across the cell wall, you see on excitation this sudden spike. So this is just sodium rushing in. Then when the sodium is balanced, there's a small fall in the transmembrane potential, but then what happens is calcium, which has a much slower dynamics than sodium, is still coming in so that it balances the ions going in and going out, and you've got a Plato-kind region. And then when the calcium is also balanced, finally you have just the potassium ions going out, and then gradually this membrane potential goes down to the resting state of about minus 85 millivolt. So this is the typical spike observed during what is known as the action potential, or during the excitation of a cardiac cell. So there have been several models, and as...
You're not left with the state you had before.
Sorry?
You're not left with the state you had before. You have potassium has gone out.
Okay.
It's coming.
Right.
And you have to.
Right. Thank you. When it goes back to the resting membrane potential, things have not yet gone back to what it seemed like, because now you've got these pumps working to pump out the sodium and bringing in the potassium. So that is what is known as a refractory period, when the cell still is trying to recover back to the resting state. Thank you for pointing it out.
Refractory is nothing with the pump.
Sorry?
Refractory is nothing to do with the pump. That's just the inactivation. The pump is not even the model in there. In this model, it's assumed that the concentration remains constant, doesn't even change outside inside the cell.
Yeah, right. The concentration only, okay. And for example, there have been different classes of models depending on how much you want to model in. Okay. So for example, Luo-Rudy, the second version of the model, puts in a lot of all this concentration. But the first version of the model actually assumes the potassium and the sodium concentration to be constant, and the calcium concentration is actually, that dynamics is built in. Yeah. Okay, so there have been several models of cardiac action potentials. Now, it depends upon you how much detail you want to build in. So as Leon asked, why are all these models bad? The reason is, of course, that if you want to really put in all the reality all the realistic stuff you want to, you'll have literally hundreds or maybe even thousands of ion channels. Nobody's even sure whether they have managed to identify all sorts of ion channels. Okay, so how many ion channels are you going to incorporate? So assuming that all these ion channels are important, you'd say that all of your models are actually just approximations of reality. So maybe all of them are, you know, not accurate. But when a physicist enters the arena, of course, he feels that, you know, maybe it's not so important to build in all the ion channels. Maybe some of these are just insignificant details. So that is why we kind of work with bad models, but different kinds of bad models. So sometimes we work with Lu-Rudy model, which is a complicated model with lots of ion channels. Or sometimes you work with a modified Fizu-Nagumo, which doesn't have ion channels per se, which just has a, you know, a recovery variable which tries to somehow approximate the action of ion channels. And if we see behavior which is kind of invariant with respect to these models, we hope that, you know, this will remain invariant whatever the kind of details of ionic channels they put in. So Lu-Rudy is a model of cardiac action potential derived from electrophysiological experiments done on the guinea pig cell. And it has about 8 coupled differential equations for a single cell describing the different variables such as the transmembrane potential, the intracellular calcium concentration, and 6 ion channel gating variables. So most different models actually vary in this respect. So they have lots of different ion channels, lots of different ion channels, and so that is how models vary. So just to give you an impression of the Lu-Rudy model, so this is the heart of the model. This is, of course, for several, this is for a tissue, not for a single cell. So the single cell part is over here. So here you've got the ionic contribution. LR stands for, of course, the Lu-Rudy model. This is the capacitance density of the membrane. And this is the spatial part. Okay. So this part stands in for the electrotonic current that are coming from the other cells, leading to the spatial propagation of excitation. This doesn't look so bad, except that you realize that this is actually composed of several ionic currents. In the Lu-Rudy, it's composed of 2 invert currents, the fast sodium and the slow calcium, and 4 types of outward current, you know, classified according to what kind of ion channels they go through. So you've got the time-dependent potassium current, the time-independent potassium current, the plate of potassium current, and the background current, which is also composed of potassium ions mostly. And each of these currents are actually functions of the ion channel variables. So for example, M, A, J, D, F, these are all, you know, ion channel opening, closing probabilities, and so on. And they are also functions of the transmembrane potential. The calcium itself has an equation involved with its increase. So it depends upon both the slow invert calcium current, as well as this part actually models the internal release of calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum. So the cell has an internal storehouse of calcium, which releases calcium when, you know, because of this slow invert current, the calcium concentration inside rises beyond some threshold. Each of the ion channel gating variables are governed by differential equations of these kind, and this depend upon the membrane potential also. So I'm not even showing, you know, what kind of dependence these alphas and betas, this opening and closing rate, but you can understand it's a fairly complicated model. So if you simulate the behavior of this model, then typically you would get a spiral wave breaking up into several multiple spirals. So these are just snapshots.
Okay, can I ask?
Yeah, sure.
Roughly speaking, I mean, there are dozens and dozens of parameters.
Right.
They are usually fixed so that this curve that you showed earlier for a single cell is well modeled.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
That, of course, won't fix 18 parameters.
Uh-huh.
So they, that it's just they're fixed through various kinds of experiments done on single cells.
Right. So, for example, URUDY actually came about because you could do. See, previously they could only do voltage clamp experiments. So you had basically Hodgkin-Huxley modified by, you know, just the parameters were varied here or there. But once you could do much more sophisticated experiments, like patch clamp, for example, then you could play around with many more variables because you had lots of data to fit, lots more data to fit. So of course you can try fitting all this thing and get those parameters.
So that I remember correctly, URUDY is actually a mixture of different animals.
The URUDY one is.
One, right? I thought it was not only guinea pig, there was some other.
No, you're probably talking about.
URUDY was only guinea pig?
URUDY one is guinea pig. URUDY 2000, the 2000 model, okay. the version V2000 is actually a mixture of different animals. Yeah, and actually, Garfinkel's group actually have used the URUDY to even model human cardiac action potential by changing some of the parameters. Right. So the length and
all I know is that there is this Fox model from Cornell, which is 100% dog.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just what is it, about 13 ionic currents, I think. If I remember correctly, and about concussion stores. And doesn't the URUDY, I mean, it doesn't reproduce some of the alternate experiments, right? If you run this experiment, if you pass this positive and positive, it doesn't show discordant alternates. All these models have defects. I mean, they have defects that you know they should have a certain property, but they don't produce it.
Well, as I said.
Another reason why they're called bad, because they do something right, but they don't other things so well. And that's why they run that.
Right.
Right. But in any case, in order to produce this, then you have to, in addition, fix some of these intercellular parameters.
Right. I mean, basically, you just look at what values Liu and Rudy were using in the papers, and you either use them or maybe you just vary them a little.
In addition to single cell, this involves coupling.
Right.
Uh-huh. How many parameters are there in these?
Oh, parameters? just the diffusion coefficient, the D I showed. Yeah. And you use that to get the correct value of conduction velocity of excitation across the tissue. So that's just one variable parameter.
I'm thinking that those gap transfer vulnerabilities are always improved indirectly.
I'm sorry?
This gap transfer vulnerability basically makes your D. Are they measured directly? Or
he says they're fitted to the velocity.
Are they improved to you?
No, that's it's not being used directly here. So we just fit the conduction velocity to fit the actual observed values. Okay, but you'd rather work with a simple model if you can. So you go to what are known as excitable media models. So excitable media are characterized by basically two properties. One is the existence of a threshold and of a refractory period. So what's a threshold? Well, there's a single stable resting state, which is known as the quiescent state of this systems. And if you give it a stimulation which falls below a certain threshold, then the perturbation just decays exponentially, and it goes back to the resting state. On the other hand, if you give it a stimulation beyond a certain threshold, then you get a characteristically large excursion from this stable resting state, and you have what is known as the excitation before it again goes back to the resting state. And the refractory period is that after you have excited the system, and for a specific duration, it cannot be re-excited, even if you give it a supra-threshold stimulation. Of course, I mean, like what I've described so far, even your lowly toilet flush is an excitable system by this definition. Okay, but many biological cells actually have these two characteristic properties, and are fairly well described by excitable media models. One of the features of excitable media are that waves of excitation do not cross each other, but when they meet, they annihilate. The reason being, of course, both have regions of refractory tissue behind them so that when they meet, they cannot pass through each other. And this leads to this characteristic spatial patterns like target waves, the so-called concentric rings, and spirals. And they have been seen in lots of different contexts. For example, in this amoeba called Dictyostelium, where they aggregate along a gradient of cyclic AMP signal. They have been seen in chemical reactions of Borisov-Zavodinsky. They've been seen in carbon monoxide oxidation on platinum 110 surface, and also in frog unfertilized egg as calcium waves. And the heart, of course, can also be seen as an excitable medium. But the excitation is this electrical wave which induces the cardiac muscle contraction, which leads to pumping of blood. So the threshold is the transmembrane potential of minus 55 millivolt, which must be exceeded before you get the characteristic action potential. So if you only excite it to some minus 60 millivolt or something, it's going to decay back to minus 80 millivolt without going through this action potential. And cells, the myocytes also have a refractory period, so that once you excite it for a certain duration, you cannot re-excite it and see the action potential. Not surprisingly, you get spiral waves in such models. And the pioneering figures are, of course, Valentin, who was here till last week, and Arthur Winfrey. And they were the ones who identified the formation of spiral waves with abnormal cardiac activity. I'm mostly focusing on a modified version of Fidzinagumo model suggested by Panfilov for looking at ventricular fibrillation. Now, this is Fidzinagumo with this so-called Puschino kinetics. So what it does is that besides the absolute refractory period, it has a so-called relative refractory period, which means that if during the relative refractory period, if you give it a large enough stimulation, it's going to fire, but not if you give it something slightly below that large stimulation. So basically, the threshold is now a function of time. This is the simplest model that I've come across that actually shows spiral breakup qualitatively similar to that which we see during ventricular fibrillation. And it also has this appealing feature that it shows that the ventricular fibrillation is actually a chaotic transient. That is, if you wait long enough, it's going to go away. But the kicker is, of course, the duration increases sharply with the system size. So if you have a small heart, then ventricular fibrillation just comes and goes. Or maybe you won't be even able to initiate ventricular fibrillation. However, if you have a large enough heart, ventricular fibrillation is extremely long-lived. So this actually agrees with the observation of physiologists that hearts of larger animals are actually more likely to show ventricular fibrillation than smaller animals, which is why mice is not a good animal model of ventricular fibrillation. You have to use rabbits or dogs. Okay, so here are the equations. As you can see, it looks fairly similar to Fidzinagumo. Dij is the conductivity tensor if you're working with anisotropic media. For an isotropic media, this, of course, just becomes a Laplacian. F of E is a nonlinear function. In a standard Fidzinagumo, this is a cubic function. But here, we use a kind of piecewise linear function. And this is the equation for the recovery variable. Now, the main modification model lies here. In the usual Fidzinagumo, this is a constant. But now, to model in the features of absolute and relative refractory period, you have epsilon as a function of your membrane potential and your recovery variable. And whatever values you use, that gives you different regimes of spatiotemporal chaos, which I'm going to show in the next few pictures. OK, so this is a behavior of a single cell behaving according to the equations. So this is how your transmembrane potential variable behaves. So here you have got this typical depolarization, then you got a plato phase and a repolarization, and then this long recovering state. And this is how your recovery variables looks like. And this is the same thing plotted in the phase space. Okay, so if you simulate this, this is what you get.
This comes from a particular assumption about epsilon of E.
Right, exactly. I'm going to,
which you will
show. I'm going to show in the next slide, transparency. So for one choice of parameters, this is a typical run of the model. So these are the E variable, and this is the recovery variable. And as you can see, that it gets from a spiral, it breaks up and forms several spirals, forming a spiral turbulent state. This is a picture of how the situation changes if you change the parameter. For example, epsilon 1, okay, which is one of the parameters governing the relative refractory period. So as you decrease epsilon 1, you can see that your spiral goes from a very stable, tightly wound spiral rotating, fairly fixed. The spiral core is fairly fixed over here. Then the spiral gradually unwinds as you decrease epsilon 1. And then finally, at around the value of 0.01, it breaks up. So you can see a transition from...
This is still the same model as here.
Right, yeah. So I'm just changing the parameter epsilon 1 to show you how you can get a transition to a spiral turbulent state. The same thing when you look at local phase portrait. So basically, you are just, you know, looking at the E and G at a particular point. Okay? So if you look at this value of epsilon 1 where you were getting a tightly wound spiral, you can see that the phase portrait is almost, you know, very similar to what you were seeing for a single cell without any coupling. So this gradually becomes more and more scattered because of the spatial nature of the chaos as you decrease epsilon 1. Okay, so this is a simulation of what a normal wave propagation looks like in the Panfilov model. So this is, of course, the action potential, which is traveling along the membrane. So normally, it will be just a plane wave propagating from the apex to the base. Okay, so this is how spirals are going to form. I think, yeah, right? So you form a broken wavefront, which curls up and forms this spiral. So you can see, you know, there are transient breakups, which again join over here, and that you don't yet get a spiral breakup, but just a single spiral. Okay. And then if you start from here and simulate for some more time, you will get spiral breakup. So things are not yet bad. I mean, you can still see a single spiral. For some reason, it's getting stuck. Okay, maybe it's doing something. Anyway, so if you simulate it, you're going to see that you know, this thing is going to wind round and round, and finally, it's going to break up. Oops, maybe it's died.
Do you play from CD or do you play from hard disk?
From the hard disk.
What are the damage of the
Oh, these are no flux Naumann boundary conditions.
And is the simulation domain much bigger than what you show, or is that literally what you see?
No, this is it. This is the simulation domain.
That's a G3. Let's find excuse. I don't know. Just reboot, right?
Sorry?
You just have to reboot, I think.
Oops. Okay. So.
Do you know a hotkey that I can get out of this? Who has the hotkey?
He says there's a small button in front.
Oh, there's a button.
No, I know there's a button, but I wanted to avoid the button. Yeah, do you know the keyboard? Yeah, just wait. No, even that is great. The thing is really dead.
So this is a Mac.
It's G3 with Mac.
Oh, I see. So this was initiated by just by starting it with a plane wave or starting it. How did you initiate?
Okay, so this was initiated by actually a broken wave. broken wave. So if you saw the spiral wave demo, we started with something like, so this part is the excited wavefront, excitation wavefront, okay? And behind it, you have this refractory region.
Right, but what you put in was what you showed before, what is, how do you actually initiate this process?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the spiral wave, right? How do I initiate the spiral wave? Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. So here you got a high value of the activation variable, and here I got a high value of the recovery variable. And these are all in resting state here. So if you start from such a initial condition,
right,
what you have is the wave is going to propagate in this direction, and then as this region recovers, it's going to...
How realistic are these conditions?
Okay. We also use this, of course, you might ask, why would a wave suddenly break? Okay. A wave, sorry?
The movie missing. Is that the one part KITP?
Yeah.
Sinus wave ABI is missing.
Okay.
Cancel?
Cancel, yeah.
Spiral wave ABI is not.
Cancel, just
search.
No, just cancel it. Cancel.
So these are all your movies, it seems. I mean, this doesn't make sense. Must be the wrong file that I'm trying to open. So, which file was it?
I think we'll have to get into the network. Okay. I don't think it's...
Why do I have two of them? I do have two of them because it doesn't make sense. Oh, it had a recovery file. Oh, okay, that's probably the problem. So which one was it? This one?
Yeah.
This one?
Right.
Okay. So now you want to go to...
Slideshow.
You want to go here.
Yeah. I don't know, just forget about it.
It would be this one perhaps.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think we'll just cancel it or something.
Just cancel?
Or is it going to the shared files or something?
I don't know, I have no idea. Cancel.
Yeah.
I don't know why they don't put OS 10 on this. Operations.
Yeah, sorry, I was talking about so you might ask, like, why will you have this kind of initial condition? Okay, you can have this kind of broken wavefront because of several reasons. One is, of course, what Eberhard was mentioning, discordant alternance. So if you have discordant alternance, sometimes what you can have is partial conduction block in one region and the wave, you know, passing off without any problem in the other half. So that's one mechanism by which you can have this one. We also have a slightly more realistic way of forming this, which is this so-called S1, S2 simulation protocol, where you give your first stimulation so that your wave travels along this. Then when it's almost halfway across, you give a second stimulation along this region so that the wave blocks in this region, and then this part gradually recovers, and then it starts curling up. Sorry? Decays meaning? I mean.
Spiral breakup can happen spontaneously.
Spiral breakup, of course, happens spontaneously. The question was, how do you form the spiral in the first place? Yeah.
Right.
So this is the initial condition.
Right.
Okay.
So maybe another related question. Like in this model, you start from like random condition.
Sorry?
stuff on a, like a render image if you have it happening.
Okay. Well, a typical random initial condition is not going to show you anything. It's just going to decay back to the quiescent state. Then that's what happens. Okay, I don't think this is going to play because we have lost the connection. But anyway, I mean, if you're interested, you can just pop into my office and I'll be very happy to show you the full movie. So this does spontaneous decay to fibrillation, so there's no problem with that.
Usually, when your talk is on the web, it'll be back.
Are they putting up movies in the web?
Yeah.
Version? Okay, great, fine, yeah. Okay, so of course, so far we have been just waving hands when we are talking about spatiotemporal chaos. So if you are going to be a bit more quantitative, then you have to try to measure the Lyapunov exponent and the Kaplan-Yau dimension to try to, you know, get some numbers. So if you look at the spatiotemporal Lyapunov exponent, so this is the maximal Lyapunov exponent of the spectrum, and you can clearly see that, you know, your spatiotemporal chaotic state is a transient, because your Lyapunov exponent is positive only up to this period. So this part is where things are really bad. Okay. The lifetime of this transient increases exponentially with system size. So that if you go from L equal to 128 to L equal to 256, already you're never going to see the spiral turbulence decay back to the quiescent state for any practical period for which you simulate the model. So to further characterize the spatial nature of the Kaplan-Yau dimension, we plotted the Kaplan-Yau dimension against the system size, and we found a more on the roughly almost exponential increase with system size.
What happens with this transition?
Sorry?
I mean, it seems to be very sharp. The transition from, you know, at about 1,200, there seems to be a kicking of data. It's like the behavior of your system suddenly changed and went into, I mean, it's discontinuous even.
You're talking about the...
Well, I just wonder what happens. How does the... Of course, that would probably be obvious in the movie. And how does it restabilize? How does the
Okay. This one. Okay, so what happens typically is that you have this broken spiral state. And then, if the system size is small enough, all the spirals eventually drift to the boundaries and get eaten up, essentially. They get absorbed by the no-flux boundary condition.
And so what happens? The whole thing goes quiescent?
Yeah, everything goes quiescent. So in a actual heart, of course, what will happen is the sinus wave will then take over the rhythm.
Well, the sinus will stay all the time.
Yeah, except that...
The realistic would be to force the heart periodically.
Except that when this fibrillation is going on, the sinus wave can't even properly enter the thing before it's being killed.
It's a small perturbation as long as the chaos is active. Mm-hmm. So it probably wouldn't do very much.
No, if you try to push in a plane wave when this is in the fibrillatory state, it's going to get broken up. Yeah.
It might have an. I don't know what happens to the pattern if you also have a plane wave propagating through it. It might help it. Probably helps it instead of farming it.
Okay, so now come to the control part. So.
Question.
Yeah. Sorry?
Is it alternating?
Well, it's a core breakup, if that's what you mean. I mean, the spiral breaks up at the core, presumably through a Doppler kind of instability.
Meandering.
Yeah, the core is meandering. Well, in this particular model, alternance doesn't, you know, enter, because this model is not incapable of showing alternance. So what happens is, well, there have been some studies showing that essentially what happens is this refractory period behind a wavefront goes into kind of oscillatory transition. Okay, so if you look at the refractory period, so suppose this is a refractory period behind the wave. So then, this shows this oscillatory instability. Okay? And then when another wave comes and hits one of these peaks, it breaks up here. So if this becomes pronounced enough, this is sooner or later going to hit one of the other wave fronts. But that's a characteristic instability of the wave. Okay, so one of the ways that you can control this is, of course, if you look at the presence of the non-conducting boundaries, then you clearly realize that they are somehow helping in eliminating the spatiotemporally turbulent state. So the two key observations that prompted us to propose this control scheme were, of course, this one, the non-conducting boundaries which absorb the spiral defects, and the second is that the spirals do not last for appreciable periods in small systems. So if you decrease the system size, your lifetime of a spiral goes down exponentially. So the operating principle for the control scheme is as follows. Somehow, if you can divide the system, which is a L cross L system, into k square smaller blocks, such that each of the smaller blocks are of size L by k, so what you do is you stimulate along the boundaries of these blocks so that all these boundaries are into refractory state. Then each block is, first of all, too small to sustain spiral activity, and secondly, the boundaries are all non-conducting, absorbing. So the spirals eventually get absorbed by the block boundaries, and once all the spirals have been terminated in each of these blocks, the system goes into the quiescent state, and you withdraw the control stimulation, and the system is back in a resting state. Okay. So this is what we tried, in the Banfield model. So this is the E field and the G field, the recovery variable. So you can just barely see the stimulation, after effects of the stimulation along these boundaries. So the entire system has been divided up into four regions, and they all have non-conducting boundaries, so that the excitation over here cannot propagate over here. And each of these regions are small enough such that within this time, this entire system has been driven to a resting state. You just stimulate along a mesh electrode. Yeah, I mean, I think basically assume.
I understand you stimulate, but then you generate a wavefront.
Yeah, but the wavefront
is. Some regions will be refractory, other regions won't.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter because each of this.
But have you done it?
Yeah.
I mean, this is actually the S-tel wave propagated through.
This is the actual simulation I'm showing.
No, I'm asking is, have you actually, when you put in these electrician crosses, have you actually sent a wave across the system? I mean, the way that the doctor has to do it, right? He has to he has to depolarize that region, right?
Right, yeah.
And that's what he has done. He gave a pulse.
Yeah. We gave a pulse, then, of course, the wave propagates. But that wave interacts with all this. Little spiraling waves, and they interact, but whatever happens doesn't matter because all these things cannot propagate to this region.
Right now you constantly depolarize this region all the time.
You just apply
frequency or?
No, not very. You just apply it for a few milliseconds. That's all. You just want to.
Okay, so why isn't the whole region then? I don't understand why this is the cross.
Because this region is in the refractory state. Okay.
But why only the cross? There was a wave propagating, so it's
right.
The whole region that's in the refractory state.
Yeah, but all these waves, okay, maybe if I show you a movie, it'll be clearer. This is with a much larger system, so you have much larger number of spirals, you also require much larger number of meshes. Okay, so let's hope this one works. Oops, it went too fast. Okay. So this is a kind of system we start with. It's going too fast.
Could you explain the protocol?
Right. So what we do is, So this is our mesh electrode. And we give some stimulation along this. So then what happens is, as Eberhard says, you have this waves traveling out from this.
Where do you put in the stimulation?
Sorry?
Where do you put in the stimulation?
Along this line electrodes. So these are line electrodes. So
it was quiescent.
No, no, no. These are doing spiral things. This is a spiral turbulent state.
Oh, wait. So you first create the spiral turbulent state
right.
with no...
Exactly.
And on that state, you then instantaneously introduce these...
mesh electrode, yeah.
These meshes. So the,
right. But then
the initial condition is some kind of spiral state. Mm-hmm. And then you apply this thing.
Right.
Don't ask how, but you just do it in the computer.
Yeah.
Right. So it would be a mesh electrode or something. And then this thing propagates.
Right.
And I don't understand why your system shows across. Because I now have propagated a wave over the whole system, and the whole system has seen a depolarization.
No, but no. Typically, what happens is
about 4 pixels where there's a cross.
Okay. Typically, what happens is that this wave is not able to propagate at all, almost, because there are lots of this spiral activity. Okay.
So
this kills off the wave, okay. Essentially. Okay. So the wave typically cannot propagate beyond some 3 or 4 cells, beyond this cross.
So that's what you would show.
Yeah.
That's this cross. That's how you see a cross.
No,
there's
no explicit Neumann boundary condition. It just goes into the refractory state.
It's just an instantaneous perturbation.
Right.
And then it goes back to the uniform. That you take away the cross.
Right.
It's a one-time stimulation, right?
Yeah.
A one-time.
Okay. Let me see. Let me see if I can show it to movie to you with a smaller. Okay. So here is the movie. Oops.
Okay. I don't think if we understand. Yeah, what
we understand.
It is you did.
Okay. Sorry. Okay, so this is the initial condition that we use. So this kind of a spiral broken up state, and then we apply the mesh electrode and get to the quiescent state. So the quiescent state is this.
So after you apply that stimulation at the mesh, you don't set the mesh or the refractory, you just leave it what?
You just give the stimulation and you don't worry about the mesh.
You leave it quiescent.
Yeah.
You give the stimulation instantaneously, and then there's no more mesh.
So of course.
Why do I see the mesh down there?
I don't understand that. How can it be?
Why do I see the mesh here?
No, that's because the region has been left refractory, right?
But why would it stay refractory?
Because you're giving it for a few milliseconds, right?
Oh, you give it for longer than.
So you.
What is a few milliseconds?
Yeah. Right. So this is what, like for the Panfilov model, you apply it for about 41 milliseconds. For the Lurie model, we just require 2.5 milliseconds.
Maybe we need to know what's the time step for spiral.
Right.
What
is the spiral period?
Oh, so spiral period is, in our models, typically it varies from 150 milliseconds to about 200 milliseconds.
Yeah, but why do you see that it's crossed? I don't understand. It should have been covered.
Uh,
Oh, yes, synchronize. Yeah, but why doesn't this use away? Why doesn't it start wiggling? Wait, I guess it does.
This is more than a spiral period. It's two tags.
Yeah, this is, well, actually, this, well, in this case, the spiral period does not come in because here we already have the spiral turbulent state.
No, but just to know roughly the time scale.
Right.
Well, this is just one wave. It's fine.
Yeah.
It also changes the color
scheme
for the last one.
Yeah, right. So this is between minus 17.
Oh, you know, your grayscale is a little different.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Now I'm highlighting that. How did you decide on the mesh?
Well, it's basically obtained from our observations about what is the dependence of system size with the chaotic transient. So we wanted to pick a size which is sufficiently small that the chaotic transient is going to go down before.
Sure.
Now, the size was decided according to, like, because we already have this dependence of system of what is the size relate to,
it may have to do with
the transient duration.
But he's just taking it from the observations. But it may have to do with the size of the source.
Sorry? Yeah, if you make the thing too large, it remains, the spiral cannot be terminated in any of one of the blocks. Even if it remains in one of the blocks, then once the stimulation is withdrawn, it will again form a spiral broken up state.
So now if you set the plane wave to the system, you know, all the time there's this space thing, they're trying to send its plane wave, right?
Yeah. Right.
And I'm really interested in that effect, because the first time when you say the thing dies out, it might die out in a very disordered manner, which means that there might be regions where where plane wave could break again. And make
right.
You haven't done a sinus node rhythm experiment.
At the same time.
No, not at the same time. But
would be useful.
But what we tried to do was that in the quiescent state, we tried putting in this mesh and trying to see whether that can lead to any kind of arrhythmias. Mm-hmm. So that didn't happen. So these are the control parameters we used. As you can see that for the Pantola model, we required something like 50 microampere per centimeter square, whereas in Lewarudi we have something like 150 microampere per centimeter square. But of course, the ventricle wall has a thickness. So far, what we're doing was for 2D. So what would happen if you have a 3D? Now, the 3D problem has an additional complication in that you cannot put the electrode inside the thickness. So whatever control you can do, you can only apply on the surface, and that has to somehow propagate inwards. So these are the thickness. So the left ventricle has an average thickness of about 12 millimeters, and the right ventricle of about 4 millimeters. So when we do the simulation with a thickness, this is what happens. So this is a spiral with a thickness of about 16 units, and this is with about 8 units. And then after about 2 seconds in both cases, they have been controlled. So basically everything goes away. You can see from the grayscale values. So of course we have to modify it somewhat for thicker tissues in the sense that although for small enough thickness, the original algorithm works just fine, if you have a sufficient large thickness, then you have to apply it more than once. So what we did was we applied it in a pulsed manner where we kept it off for some duration and then again we keep it on, then keep it off like this. And typically the period for which we keep it off has to equal the duration of one action potential. So with this kind of parameters, we found that we did manage to control it even in 3D. So the implication for defibrillation is as follows. The current defib techniques, as I said, involves applying this huge shocks of 5 kilovolt for external defibrillation and 600 volt for internal defibrillation, whereas the system that has been proposed only requires about 10 to 100 microampere per centimeter square applied for very brief durations over a mesh electrode. And it was successful for both a bad complicated and a bad simple model, and it was effective even for three-dimensional control. Now, the problem with a physicist's idea about how one should go about in controlling spatiotemporal chaos is, of course, that when you meet clinicians, you realize that you have a difference in philosophy of thinking about how one should go about treating ventricular arrhythmias. So this is work I did with Crescini and Stein at Cornell, and over there they were, you know, the philosophy was that forget about fibrillation. You know, if you're gone into fibrillation, you're already dead. You're a goner. Can we do something before the patient has gone into fibrillation? So usually a fibrillation is preceded by episode of tachycardia, which is treated by this low amplitude electrical pacing. Okay, sure, no problem. So can you do something to improve the existing methods of pacing algorithms so that the patient can be, you know, recovered while he's still in tachycardia and not gone into fibrillation? So this is just a ventricular tachycardia thing. So as I said, that the motivation for looking into the anti-tachycardia pacing is if you can save the patient before he has gone into fibrillation. The problem here is that nobody knows for sure whether there is an effective optimal anti-tachycardia pacing algorithm. So the present method of treatment goes like this. If your ICD detects a ventricular tachycardia, okay, so something like a 300 millisecond period beating, it just goes into a pre-programmed mode where it starts giving high frequency bursts, say typically 6 to 8 bursts of electrical pulses, and the time period is usually 80% of the ventricular tachycardia period. So you give this rapid pulses, hopefully you're going to get back into the sinus rhythm. Often it doesn't work in the first try, so you give it many times. So here you're doing it twice, and you're getting into the sinus rhythm. You don't usually do it more than thrice, because by this time you're already cutting it too thin. If you don't get the patient back into the sinus rhythm by now, he's probably going into, you know, some serious problem. So after 3 such attempts, you just give a cardioversion, or at worst, you give him a defibrillatory shock. Now, there's another school of thought which says that this constant frequency pacing is not a smart thing to do. Rather, what you should do is you should decrease the time period of this pacing signals. Okay, so you should first give 320 milliseconds, then decrease it to 312 milliseconds, and so on. The problem is, of course, nobody knows why this should work better than this, or even if this one works better than this. There have been conflicting clinical studies, with one of which shows that this is better, one of which shows this is better. And which program your doctor is going to do to you is basically dependent upon the doctor's affiliations. Okay, so if this doctor came from a school which believed in this philosophy, he's going to do this, otherwise he's going to do this. And typically these things go like this, that after this is implanted, you go to a doctor and he changes your programming every month and asks you to come back. Provided you don't feel too bad, he says that, okay, this seems to be all right. But, you know, the next big one comes and you really hope your doctor got it right. Yeah, sure. So, the typical clinical way of thinking about ventricular tachycardia is through this anatomical reentry. So typically you have scar tissue like this, and you have a reentrant wave of excitation around it. And what you're doing in pacing is that from some remote region, you're applying high-frequency electrical waves, and you're trying to sweep away this, you know, feedback loops of electrical wave. So the philosophy is this: if the frequency of this is higher than the frequency of this, then this would be able to sweep away this electrical excitations. So this is the broad understanding. So the clinical model of ventricular tachycardia is dominantly an anatomical one, so where you have this scar tissue forming a circuit and this electrical wave goes round and round it. So what you try to do is you apply stimulation from some remote point and try to sweep this away. And you hope that provided this is of high enough frequency, you're going to do it right. Problem is, of course, if you do it a very rapid, you can't just do it at, you know, highest possible frequency. Because if you do it at a very rapid pacing, often the pacing wave itself breaks up and forms functional reentrant. Okay, so this is essentially what I said. And this is an actual electrical mapping from a patient's ventricle. And you can see two pieces of scar tissue. So usually clinicians think that these actually form the sites of cardiac reentry. So you'll have, you know, loops forming around this gray scar tissue. Okay, and what we do is we abstract this into a one-dimensional ring reentry problem where we take this figure of eight reentry and think of it as, you know, if you cut this thing, then half of this picture forms basically a reentry problem around a ring. There are these entrance and exit stripe branches which models the other, the surrounding portion of the myocardium. So waves coming from the surrounding region of myocardium and wave from here goes out to the other regions of myocardium, and your problem is how to kill the reentrant wave. Now there has been a long study on this problem. The problem boils down to this, that here is the pacing wave which comes into the reentry circuit and splits up into two branches, one of which is parallel to the reentrant wave, one of which is counter to the reentrant wave. You don't have to worry about this one because this is going to meet this one and they're going to terminate each other. The problem is what to do with this. If this survives, then this just becomes the new reentrant wave. So you have what is known as resetting. Okay. So how to terminate this wave is essentially the key of anti-tachycardia pacing. Now, there are lots of factors which influence the ability of pacing to be successful in terminating reentry. So I've just listed a few of them. And you can see that for pacing to be successful, therefore, you require actually multiple stimulus rather than a single stimulus. So Glass and Josephson in 95 had done some study, and based on quantitative arguments, they showed that if the pacing site is on the ring itself, then there is always a small duration of time during which if you apply a pacing stimulus, your pacing wave, the branch which is parallel to the reentrant wave, is going to fall on the refractory tail of the reentrant wave and is going to terminate, and therefore you're going to have termination. The problem is, of course, this doesn't work if you have the pacing site located away from the reentry circuit. The reason being, by the time this wave comes into the ring or manages to enter the ring, the refractory tail is always far away. So you all have the problem of catching up with the reentrant wave. So what we found was that here, inhomogeneity plays a crucial role. If there is some kind of inhomogeneity, a zone of slow conduction, or a region of high refractoriness, then this slows down the recovery of this part, and therefore the pacing wave which comes in meets the refractory region and dies. So this is how typically a wave works. Anyway, forget about this. Okay, so this is a simulation of a LuRoD1 model. So we put in a region of slow conduction at this point, and we showed that under certain situations, the branch of the pacing wave which you want to terminate does manage to halt at this zone. So at this point, you have termination of reentry. And this is the parameter space diagram just to show that you have a significant duration at which you can get termination. And this is how the mechanism works of reentry termination. So at the region, at the boundary of the zone of slow conduction, you have enormous amplification of the action potential duration and hence the refractory period. So therefore, it's at these boundaries that when the pacing wave comes, it meets a region of enormously long refractory period and dies. If you look at, excuse me, if you look at the ionic current and the electrotonic current, you can see what is happening is essentially what goes by the name of post-repolarization refractoriness, that is a refractory period which is much longer than what you'd expect, even after the cell has repolarized. So essentially what has happened here is that the ionic current has still not decayed at the zone of slow conduction, where the next wave comes in and starts to push in electrotonic current. Since the electrotonic current and the ionic current works opposite each other, they are going to cancel each other out, and you're not going to have termination of the parallel branch of the reentry. Okay, I don't think this movie is going to work. So this is what happens in two dimension. So here is this reentrant wave going round and round, and you're giving the pacing wave from below. And as you can see that, you know, if you do this for homogeneous media, at the end of it, you still have the reentrant wave going round and round. On the other hand, if you have inhomogeneous media, where you have a zone of slow conduction in this channel, and usually that is what is clinically observed, because effectively what you have is dead cells interspersed with live cells, so the wave takes a long time to go through this narrow channel. And then, over here, what happens is that the wave, while passing through this small region of inhomogeneity, dies out, and therefore, at the same time as in the previous one, we do have termination of reentry. We also did it with anisotropic media, and the results didn't change qualitatively. So finally, what does this say about pacing algorithms that are being used currently? These present methods were all developed heuristically, based on trial and error. On the other hand, what we are trying to do is use spatiotemporal dynamics of interaction between pacing and reentrant waves to suggest better methods of pacing algorithms. So what we have done is that we presented general arguments that inhomogeneities in the reentry circuit are essential for successful termination of ventricular tachycardia by any realistic pacing arrangement. And by realistic, I mean where the electrode is placed further away from the reentry circuit. And therefore, considering the presence of inhomogeneities during placement of pacing electrode may lead to more efficient termination of reentry. So I thank you for your interest.
First, one question.
Well, has anybody tried this out on, let's say, animals?
This one?
Either of them. Either the fibrillation or the...
No.
I mean...
Well, the inhomogeneity one, you know, reminds me of the first talk by Bill Stevenson. He told us that they go in and try to destroy the entrance circuits by burning things up. But the question is, do they really burn them, or do they just make them very homogeneous? And then actually, your take, I don't know whether it will...
No, you have an algorithm there of electrical stimulation.
Yeah.
I mean, are you... Would it be sensible to try to actually try it out?
Sure, but except that the problem is, of course, to convince experimenter to do it.
Well, the problem is we need an animal. I mean, you want to do this on a live animal, right? You have to have the heart in the finish, right? So you have to know where the human is. It's a difficult experiment.
Yeah, do you have a protocol for actually finding the right algorithm for figuring out the geometry?
The geometry of what?
Well, this depends on some inhomogeneities.
Right.
How are you going to find those inhomogeneities?
Well, I mean, when you do electrical mapping of the heart, you do find the inhomogeneities. I mean, like the picture I showed of his heart, and all those colors actually were representing, you know, the zone of slow conduction, zone of fast conduction, and so on.
And that information is enough for you to figure out the protocol?
Yeah. In a simple geometry like this.
Right, but then he has a protocol for...
Then in addition, he would have a protocol to get rid of the stuff, right? Without resetting the heart totally. I still have, I mean, sorry that I have another question. The first part of the talk, have you considered inhomogeneity?
No.
Because it seems to me that might be crucial whether this mechanism of putting this cross and actually would work or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because inhomogeneity might cause, you know, you think that rectangular grid is the right thing to do, but if you have an inhomogeneous heart, it's...
Right.
No, you should try a random grid. I'm not sure it depends on the regularity of the grid.
We did try deforming the grid by small amounts, and that didn't make any difference.
But shouldn't
you should try random grid.
Random grid meaning? I mean,
inhomogeneity
would, I think. Yeah, putting other inhomogeneity.
Why grid at all? Why would
it foil? The foil is easy, like a foil is always going to do it. Foil is like a global control.
Yeah, so what's the advantage of putting against the foil?
Well,
putting in, for example, I mean, I could easily imagine what they right now do is when they come in to use somewhere and then they put in just one electrode or two electrodes. That's what they do regularly. I mean, they do that all the time. And it might not be so hard to put in actually something that unfolds and makes just either a line, just one line.
Inside the heart.
Yeah, just one electrode that, you know, this thing just unfolds and just goes clunk and you know, wire comes out and then you send a current through the wire voltage, right? And right now they just have electrodes. Oh yeah, sure, they do that. But right now they do that, right? They poke through this thing against the heart and the thing goes like this. And it's very true, right? These things are very good. But if something that... So one could easily imagine having a ring, for example, and a ring electrode instead of a flexible wire. You know, it would bend. It's some elastic steel that bends. And so it's feasible. I mean, it's an interesting idea of dividing the heart into two parts, for example. Just two might be a nice thing. Has anybody tried that?
No.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of engineering because you have to build this thing and cost a lot of money.
But actually, what there is an analog thing. The Mace surgery, what they do is that they actually burn out the heart, several dead tissues, so that the heart is effectively divided into several small regions. So effectively, what they're doing is they're permanently damaging the heart to it.
Right. Okay, well thank you very much.